Get ready for the smartest bundle in streaming. 6 streaming services for the intellectually curious. Featuring Curiosity Stream with the best collection of documentary films and TV shows. Psalm TV and great stories from the world of wine. Taste Made for the fun side of food and travel. Topic with the best thrillers and crime stories. And so much more. From nature to history, technology to food, mystery to adventure. Get 6 streaming services for one low price and less than $6 a month. It's the best deal in streaming. Learn more and sign up now at smartbundle.com.
Nobody came through Black Valley anymore. Not since the creek dried up and the railroad passed it by. The last settlers left years ago, leaving behind nothing but a few dilapidated shacks clustered around a shallow trench where water once ran down from the Sierra Nevadas, the blue-green peaks looming over the western horizon. It was a ghost town in every sense of the word, and that was why Elmer Rudry liked it so much. The high desert was warm and peaceful, with little more than a stiff breeze to disturb the stillness of the afternoon, or the howling of distant coyotes at night. Nothing ever moved, nothing ever changed, and that was just the way he liked it. The old man struck a singularly pathetic figure, dressed in rags that had once been a flannel shirt and gray pants, leaning on a stick as he hobbled between the crooked, half-collapsed buildings and what had been, once upon a time, the center of the town's commercial district. His hair was bleached white from age, and the hot desert sun, falling across his shoulders and mingling with an equally long beard, which blew stiffly as the breeze passed by. His hat was ragged, his boots so full of holes that it was a wonder the old leather soles clung together at all. It was a wonder he still bothered wearing them at all, with his hardened feet used to walking long distances across the hot earth, grinding his soles like fine-grained sandpaper. Some affectations died hard, he supposed, like his ragged outfit, a holdover from the days when men still lived in this town, when cool, clear water flowed down from the mountains like the very blood of God. He shook his head, catching himself. He couldn't afford to get nostalgic now. He'd long ago made his choice to stay, and there was no point dwelling in the distant past. How long had it been since the last time he saw a human face? A smooth one, a fresh one, free of the cracks and scars and strange, writhing, dripping things that flowed from the mouth and nostrils of a fresh corpse. 10 years? More? He shrugged, and a wave of sand rolled down his shoulders like a caustic avalanche, clinging to the reddish, irritated flesh on his back. Too many years of sun had first turned his skin the color and consistency of rough Apache leather, then irritated it, wrinkles cracking and splitting apart, catching sand and sending thin streams of pus down his back. It used to bother him. Not anymore. Nothing bothered him anymore. Not the sun, not the sand, not the emptiness of his stomach, nor the infernal dryness of his throat. He looked up, and realizing he was in the saloon, made his way over to the counter, where an empty whiskey bottle sat alongside a row of shot glasses, cracks running across the glass like spiderwebs. He remembered whiskey, the burn as it slid down the throat, the courage, the wild, carefree abandon it inspired after a long day's march. It was gone. He brushed the skeleton of a scorpion off the bar and watched it shatter across the floor. Then he made his way up the creaking flight of stairs to the rooms of the upper floor. Each step creaked ominously beneath his feet, the nails rusty, the wood cracked and warped from years of varying temperatures. 4 of the 5 doors were shut, and the old man paid them no attention as he made his way to the far room, whose door he could barely remember removing the hinges from in some long, distant vista of memory. The object of his quest lay on the bed. 206 bones, 32 teeth, he'd counted them meticulously during the long days in which there was nothing left to do. They were all intact, pristine, and bleached the same white as his beard, thanks to the sun and ants. He was just lucky he'd found it before the scavengers got to it. As it was, all that was missing were a few pieces of skull, which he'd been unable to find no matter where he looked. Possibly, whoever made the hole had taken them with him. Why, he couldn't say, but any man who could leave such a fine corpse lying in the desert was sure to have some strange ways. Next to the body lay a moldy old belt and a chunk of rusted together metal that may have once been a revolver, though the make was impossible to tell. The old man picked it up, resting his bony finger on the rusted trigger, and made a motion with his thumb as if cocking the missing hammer. He held it out, fixing the shattered forehead of the skull between the rust-clogged sights, then set it down again. He opened his mouth, a single, blackened incisor hanging from frayed tendons. His first attempt at speaking sent him into a fit of coughing, as countless weeks of accumulated dust flowed between his thin lips. When the dust settled and his throat was reasonably empty, he shook his head and began a long practiced speech.
Aya, Cthulhu, Fategan,
he rasped, his dry, cracked tongue straining to shape the unusual syllables.
Finglui, Mogul Winfa, Cthulhu,
Yakut Shaber Yog Sothoth. The corpse responded in a tone as hollow as the space within the ribcage.
Hagen Tadnor, Ug Krugnog.
I never heard of such a thing, the old man sputtered. The things what live beneath Snake Hill, they'd have told me. Your death approaches, Elmar. The corpse's tone was almost apologetic. You know they would never tell you. You might panic and flee. And then they'd have to venture out in the daytime and fight with the other scavengers to claim what belongs to them. I tell you, Elmer Rudry belongs to Elmer Rudry, no matter what the buggies say. You sold yourself cheap, you know. Your Christian God may not exist, but there are certain places what are warmer than others, and a damn sight colder than this desert, where even the children of Yig dare not dwell. Them snakes ain't worth the lead it takes to put 'em down. The old man's voice grew steadier as he got used to speaking. I always wanted to burn their hives, or at least drop some dynamite down their holes and seal the entrances. Keep 'em from gobbling down any unwary travelers. And hitch a ride out of here, the corpse finished for him. It's been too long, longer than the bargain. A rattling sound emerged from between the jaws of the skull, something akin to laughter. Bastard. I should have left you where I found you. You don't bargain with Hall Krava, nor the black goat with 1,000 young.
Finglui, Benglaf, Cthulhu Relay, Oiga Noggle, Fatagan,
the old man intoned, and with a sound like rustling paper, the skeleton fell silent once more. The year was 1862, and Private Rudry was riding hard through the desert, kicking up a plume of dust that rose like smoke from one of the big factories back in St. Louis. His once gray uniform was coated in red dust, same with his hat and the scruffy 3-day beard clinging to his narrow chin. He held the reins in his teeth, and he struggled to load his revolver, but the constant rocking of the saddle made it nearly impossible to pour the powder into each of the cylinders in the revolver, and he knew he'd need them all. The Western campaign was over. New Mexico was firmly in Union hands. Sibley and Tom Green were retreating, along with 2,000 of Texas's best men, 400 of whom now lay dead in Western dust. Back home to Arizona, and from there to Texas, and then what? All the way back to Virginia, to hold off the Yankee savages by digging trenches in farmyards and town squares from Richmond to Atlanta? Rudry couldn't read. But it didn't take some northern intellectual to understand the signs. It was doomed, the whole damned war, and he wasn't going to die in some godforsaken foxhole or catch the flu and meet the Creator without ever meeting the enemy. No, he was headed west, west beyond the Sierra Nevada, where the sun rose above an ocean as expansive as the desert, which now surrounded him in all directions. In the chaos of the retreat, who would have noticed a soldier slipping away, stealing a horse and riding off into the night? Somebody, apparently, or they wouldn't have sent these men after him. There were 4, but he shot one on the second night, when he made the mistake of making camp in the open, and the other disappeared soon after. Maybe he was snakebit, and died raving and alone as his comrades pressed on. It pained him to think of any man dying in such ignominy, let alone a fellow Southerner, but it couldn't be helped. He was with the Lord now, and surely reaping his just reward for loyal service to the cause. As for himself, he knew his soul was well beyond saving. His sin was worse than murder, worse than sodomy. If he thought service to the Southern cause could save his soul, he was sorely mistaken, as loneliness and isolation only drove him onward, into the depths of depravity which even the wicked men of Nineveh would find abhorrent. Even the Yankee foe, for all his cruelty, would have given him a quick death just to rid the world of his sin all the more quickly. Sodom and Gomorrah, on the plains south of what men call the River Jordan, Albuquerque and Santa Fe, south of Rio Puerco. Truly, the Lord hath granted him a taste of the fires to come, in which his deviant soul would become another morsel on the devil's own barbacoa. He was a good little sinner, though, and he wouldn't be content with simply laying down and accepting the fires willingly. The war lay behind him, but it was catching up fast. He could hear the hoofbeats of his pursuers just meters behind him, unable to shoot or even see in the cloud of dust from his horse's hooves. It was about all the old mare was good for. After a full week of running, drove the energy from the poor beast. God really did abandon this land. It was like a blank spot upon the face of creation, an unfinished corner bereft of life, save for rattlesnakes and cacti, whose moist flesh was the only reason he hadn't died 4 nights ago, when his last canteen ran out. The Colt's Dragoon he carried was a gift from a Union lieutenant. Back at Glorieta Pass, the boy's soul had been commended to the Lord, where he only hoped the boy received mercy for his sin of fighting against the glorious Confederacy. The bayonet of his rifle still dripped with the boy's blood when he pulled the pistol from his limp fingers and delivered a coup de grace, a kindness better than bleeding to death or dying of infection in some butcher's field hospital. It was a powerful little beauty, but Lord, the trigger pull was a long one, and the kick was worse than a mule. If you weren't careful firing, you could snap your wrist clean down the middle, and if you didn't load it correctly, too much powder or too little, the thing could just as easily blow up in your hand and do the enemy's job for him. Jesus, Mary, and all the saints, he muttered, rotating the cylinder and clicking the lock into place. Blessed be the Lord my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight. Glancing over his shoulder, he could see the silhouettes of the riders shifting as they fanned out, one on each side and riding hard to escape the smoke screen. The one on the left came out first, his gray uniform hidden beneath a brown long coat and a revolver rifle in his hands. It was a powerful weapon in the right hands, a step between a musket and one of Henry's new repeaters. But there was enough room in the breech that dirt could easily get in, which is why when the gunman raised the rifle and took aim, Rougerie didn't bother to duck. There was a click, and another, and then an explosion, and the sensation of air whipping past his face. He turned just in time to see the other rider coming up behind him, his unbuttoned coat flapping behind him like a cape. The weapon in his hands was a Henry, and Rougerie cursed to high heaven as another bullet tore past him, barely scraping the back of his collar. Another shot cracked out by the time Rougerie got his bearings, this one grazing the horse's haunch and causing the poor beast to cry out, stumbling slightly as blood trickled down its leg. It was barely a scratch, and Rougerie spared the beast no mercy, jamming his spurs into the horse's bloody thighs. He could see the rider coming alongside him, rifle at the ready for a single, clear shot. The fully loaded dragoon felt heavy in his hands, too heavy for a man to hold. It wasn't designed to kill men, really, but Nephilim and Indians, which Rougerie quietly suspected were the same thing, having never met any of either party. He didn't bother looking, he just pulled the trigger. The bark of the gun was nothing compared to the screaming of the horse, as the bullet tore through its thick hide, lodging itself deep in its chest. Its legs buckled, and now it was the rider's turn to scream, as he was thrown from the saddle, landing head first with an awful crunch. One threat down, he turned to the second gunman, but as he turned around, all he could see was empty desert, red sand and wind-blown rocks in every direction. In one direction, however, a pair of buttes stuck out against the noonday sky, and between them, a faint cloud of dust receded into the distance. The coward bolted. Rougerie chuckled, and the fallen rider groaned, southern blood trickling from a gash in his scalp and spilling across the damned Yankee sand. Hopping down from his saddle, Rudry pulled a bowie knife from the sheath on his belt and put an end to the poor wretch. The horse's legs were twitching, but the bullet had clearly hit something vital. He hefted his revolver and considered putting a round into it, but his bullet pouch was dreadfully light. The Henry, on the other hand, was caught between the beast's belly, with only part of the now bent barrel sticking out. It didn't take a gunsmith to know it'd be useless, even if he could shove the 1,000 or so pounds of dead weight off of it. With only slight regret, he climbed back on the horse, turned, and made to follow his other pursuer. The hunter was now the hunted. Revolver in hand, Rudry crept through the ruined stockade and into the ghost town. Black Valley was the name, according to a bullet-scarred sign hanging from the sheriff's office. He guessed it was the sheriff's office on account of the rusty iron cage sitting in the center of the otherwise empty building. It must have been a fine town in its day, though how long ago that was, he dared not venture a guess. It could have been built any time between last week and Coronado's first visit to the region more than 2 centuries prior. Maybe the local gold or silver mine ran dry, or maybe there never was one to begin with. Some Yankee shyster selling stakes in a phony mine, stealing people's life savings while they slowly died out in some godforsaken wilderness. It wouldn't be the first time, and with the defeat of the glorious cause, all but inevitable, it sure as shootin' wouldn't be the last. There were a good dozen structures still standing, mostly 1 or 2 room shacks, along with the aforementioned sheriff's office, a small church, a saloon, the only 2-story building in town, if you didn't count the upper level of the church, which Rudry didn't, as the roof had mostly caved in on top of it. In the dying light, and in the light of his sin, he passed it by, scarcely turning to glance inside. He was glad he did, however, as a shift in the darkness caught his attention. Movement. He dropped to his knees just in time for a bullet to rip past him, ricocheting off a rock just behind him. He raised the revolver and let off a round of his own, the flash illuminating the entryway to the church, and for just a moment, he can make out the silhouette of a man behind a pew, his face pale behind the sights of his rifle. He ducked, giving Rudry time to move for cover behind the empty doorway. A volley rang out. 1, 2, 3 shots. The first 2 hitting the ground, and the last one slamming into the doorframe and sending out a flurry of splinters. 4 shots fired in total, 2 left, while he still had 5.44 bullets loaded in his dragoon. "Don't come any closer," the man in the church shouted. "Damn you! Damn you!" He was moving around, fumbling in the dark. Rudry could hear the pew screeching as he shoved them out of his way. "Damn yourself," he responded. "Put it down and we'll get our backsides out of this here fire hole." "You killed Jim! He was shooting at me. What do you expect me to do? Shake his hand? Damn you!" "You said that already, kid." The gunman responded with another shot, but this one didn't hit near the door. There was a loud splashing sound like a rock thrown in water, followed by a strange, half-strangled yell from the gunman. "What in the blazes?" Rudry muttered, peeking around the door, but he could see nothing past the small entryway. The rest of the interior cloaked in shadow. Something was definitely moving in there, but whether it was the gunman or something else entirely, he couldn't say. There shuffling sounds as if something very large were moving across the floor toward the back of the church. Turning the corner, Rudry fired a shot, and the flash brightened the entire church, right to the back. In that split second, he got a good look at the interior, a few rows of wooden pews leading to a pulpit, behind which sat the remains of a large cross, the horizontal beam having fallen off, and was now leaning against the vertical one. Between them, though, Rudry blinked, and everything was dark once more. For just a second, he fancied that he saw something faint, indistinct, standing between the pulpit and the cross, a kind of splotch of shadow. In the darkened church, nothing unusual, save that it seemed to be relegated to a single spot in midair. He didn't spare a second to think about it. More importantly, the gunman was nowhere to be seen, probably hiding behind a pew, and Rudry had just exposed himself. Rudry leapt behind the doorway, waiting for the kid to make his move, but nothing came, and after a few long seconds, he ventured to shout, "Hello?" After a few seconds with no response, he grasped his pistol tightly and slowly peeked around the corner. When no shots came, he stepped into the open and stood for a second, then took a couple steps into the church, where the light from the setting sun gave way to near-pitch darkness. As he stood there in the still silence, he noticed a faint sound coming from behind one of the pews, barely audible above the faint ringing in his ears from his previous shot. Behind the bench lay the gunman, as white as Georgia cotton, and twisted into an expression that sent a shiver down the hardened soldier's spine. The man's body was twitching, his hands and feet shaking, as if in the throes of an epileptic seizure, but that wasn't it. It was as if he was struggling against something, or at least, that was the impression Rudra got from the way he thrust his hands forward, only to slam them back down, as if being shoved by powerful hands.
"Damn you! Damn you!
He muttered incessantly, his tongue straining to give shape to the words, as blood trickled from the cracks in his parched lips. His entire lower face was covered in the stuff, like a sanguine beard. The blood was so thick he could smell it. A quick visual inspection showed no obvious signs of injury. No entry wounds where Rudri's shot might have ricocheted and hit him. The poor fool's brain was scrambled, probably half-baked from too many long hours under the unforgiving New Mexico sun. Rudri had seen it all before, men dropping mid-march and dying on the burning sand, having never met the enemy. They were useless. Orders were to leave them where they fell, as dragging them along would only slow the column down. It was the same for him now. What could he do for the madman? He could splint a broken bone or stitch shut a gaping wound. That was it. Should he tie him down to keep him from gouging his own eyes out, sharing his water with him even though he was bound to die anyway? Grunting, he pulled out his knife and dug it deep in the man's throat. He hardly responded to the cut, barely bled in fact, for which Rudri was eminently grateful. He didn't even gurgle as he died. Rudri felt his way through the church, stepping carefully to avoid tripping on a loose board. The moon rose quickly, filling the room with a pale light that cast queer shadows over everything. Rudri stopped and glanced around, blinking in surprise. Had he lost track of time? He'd taken a pocket watch from the man whose horse he'd shot, but he didn't have a clue how to read it. Something moved in the corner of his eye, near the pulpit. He spun around, gun at the ready, but nothing was there. "Bats," he muttered, and slipped his gun back into the holster. To his surprise, there was a book on the pulpit, but it wasn't a Christian Bible. Instead of a cross, the cover bore the image of a stick with five branches, three on one side, two on the other. It was cast from silver, shining faintly in the moonlight. Maybe that was the movement. He let out a chuckle, then stopped, as the sound seemed to profane the silence which had settled around him. The book was strange, no doubt about it. Elmer Rudri could read no better than he could speak Dutch, and the language of the book was definitely not Dutch. They weren't letters like any he'd ever seen before. A lot of squiggly shapes with hooks, curves, and little dots sprinkled here and there like drops from a leaking pen. Every few pages was an illustration, portraying monsters of all shapes and sizes, none of which looked even slightly familiar to him. There were things without heads, with squiggly lines spewing from their mouths. How a headless creature could have a mouth was beyond him, but that was what was portrayed. One image, to which he felt particularly drawn, appeared to be a normal human man, hands and feet outstretched to show off his body. If he were a scholarly type, he'd have recognized the outline of Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. The outline was where the similarities ended, however, as closer inspection revealed certain anatomical irregularities, particularly centered around the subject's groin. Retching slightly in his mouth, Rudri flipped the page, not caring if he ripped the fragile vellum. He found himself drawn to the strange scribbles. His eyes glazed over the longer he stared at them, the funny little hooks and curves writhing across the page, like so many little ringworms in the skin of a dying sow. They were beautiful, in their own unusual way, and before he could tear himself away, He'd read the spread pages 5 times over.
"This ain't Christian," he muttered to himself. But then, he was hardly a Christian anymore, and so he turned the page, the ancient vellum crinkling beneath his calloused fingertips.
"Aya Cthulhu," the old man repeated, staring down at the corpse on the bed. "Aya Cthulhu, there ain't no end for me, not on this mortal earth."
He repeated that same phrase as he hobbled out of the saloon, adjusting his hat to keep the sun out of his sensitive eyes. Too many years of reading alone in the dark had turned them milky and dim, even though they weren't really useful with the kinds of books he read. He could feel it in his forehead, pulsing, the little cone-shaped gland that Dee so loved to expound upon, and Alhazred harbored such a desire to caress that, in a fit of mad lust. The prophet cracked his own skull with a rock and dug through useless tissue to find the thing. Rudri had never gone quite that far, though the dark, lonely nights did sometimes drive him to strange extremes regardless. He could taste colors now and hear smells. The sunlight was too loud these days, pounding in his ancient ears even louder than his own heartbeat, which had recently taken up the tune of an old marching song from
Aya Cthulhu.
He banished the thought with another repetition of his mantra, the one he'd repeated so many times over the decades.
"Death, O the firstborn, and welcome, the rain o' frogs. Teacheth mine hands not for war, O great ones, but to sin and make merry until the coming."
He learned it from his book, the terrible book, the wonderful book, whose presence on the church pulpit was at once inexplicable and miraculous. It was as if God himself led him to it, though he knew instinctively that the mere existence of such a tomb was absolute evidence against his existence. No good, orderly world could ever suffer the knowledge contained within that accursed thing. The words never did make sense to him, but every time he looked, he felt like he was learning. New knowledge simply popped up in the back of his brain, as if he knew it all along. Indeed, the only unease he felt anymore was the idea that, in some vague, ill-defined time, he hadn't known these things. Shoggoth Cumhaili, creatures of the blackest text. They lived, the words, letters, and language. They had lived and they forever would, ensnaring his soul in their web of horror and beauty from the day he first gazed upon the thing. His body waned as his mind waxed strong, muscle fading, feebleness setting in, but it was a small price to pay for the things he learned. He learned of spheres beside our own, beings far beyond the realm of human understanding. He saw cities wreathed in flame, trains that flew through the air like great serpents. Or was it serpents like great trains? He couldn't remember. It had been years since he'd seen that particular page. He could try and look it up again, but the pages had a tendency to change whenever he wasn't looking at them. The vast octopoid things would rise from the deep and reclaim their land. Perhaps it had already happened. The scale of time in the book was rather strange, as was his own perception of it. Born of countless decades of isolation, it could have been eons, for all he knew. Men were gone and the world was ruled by rabbits, who remembered the former dominant species only as a predatory boogeyman who came for disobedient little kits in the dead of the night. Well, those were all after his time. His life, unnaturally elongated though it was finally nearing an end. Or was it a beginning? For a man such as he, death was but a door, time but a window, and with his knowledge, there were certain ways of cheating it. Snake Hill, for example, and them what lived beneath. His close friends and allies through all these long years would surely be able to help, or at least give him an alternative to whatever foul oblivion into which his consciousness might be thrown upon the cessation of his heartbeat. Snake Hill lay just to the east of town, no more than an hour's walk. But by the time the old man arrived at the base of the low rise of earth, it was nearing nightfall. He didn't own a lantern,
nor did he see fit to bring so much as a flintstone and a piece of steel. In the dark, his bleary eyes were even less useful than usual. But he knew the way to the entrance by heart, having made the trip almost weekly for countless years. It didn't take a lot of poking around for him to find the hole, small enough to be mistaken for a rabbit's warren, and poking a toe inside. He jostled it a bit, trying to disturb the inhabitant enough to come out.
"Come on, feller," he rasped. "We got business, you and I."
Something warm and wet pressed against his toe, and he pulled it back just as a green polypus thing oozed out. It shifted and swelled before him, swallowing up dirt and sand mites and scorpions, whatever didn't get out of the way in time. Rudri practically leapt back, landing hard on his ankle, but it didn't break, despite the cracking sound and the burst of pain. If his suspicions were correct, it didn't matter anyway. He wasn't going to be walking anywhere anytime soon. It was as big as a fair-sized horse, covered in a kind of gelatinous outer layer, thick enough to conceal whatever lay beneath. The surface was dotted with orifices with thick, almost human-like lips, constantly opening and closing, gasping in air and exhaling puffs of blue smoke, whose smell wrinkled the old man's nose and stung his eyes. The creature had no real limbs, but every once in a while, one of the orifices would open up, and a long, slender tendril would emerge to swat a fly, or capture it and drag it inside the thing's maw. It wasn't eating, of course. Any fool could tell that such a beast took no sustenance upon this mortal plane. As he stared at it, he noticed that the thing appeared to be seething, the surface rippling like an ocean in a storm, full of little air bubbles that burst as they rose to the top of the gelatinous layer. It was about as clear as mud, and the sun didn't shine on it so much as through it, getting lost somewhere in the depths of the semi-liquid surface. It almost seemed to swallow the light, or perhaps to radiate darkness. Either way, it stuck out like a sore tooth amid the ruined town. A pair of tendrils emerged from the creature's belly, covered in thick, oily pus that hissed as it dripped on the ground. They twisted into a shape like a sailor's knot, and Elmar repeated the motion, doing his best approximation with his hands. A low gurgle rose from one of the orifices in the creature's side, and a foul, greenish mist began to pump out. The smell was acrid, even by Elmar's standards, a mixture of burnt cordite and the gas which builds up inside a corpse, only to rupture and spread its putrescence through the hot, dry desert air. Opening his arms and closing his eyes, he inhaled the foul stench and savored it like a sommelier nosing a fine wine.
"Eye of Cthulhu," he muttered to nobody in particular. Certainly not the beast, whose sensory organs couldn't possibly perceive such a mundane form of communication as speech. There was a strange sensation in his loins, and he looked down to see an erection, something he hadn't experienced in more decades than he cared to count. He smirked at the sight. Human procreation was so delicate, so fragile, so utterly limited that it was hard to describe it as procreation at all. More like cloning, or spreading the seed of some wild desert flower. Only fools cared for such things. Fools and creatures so low in evolution that they were like comparing men with ants. Or perhaps, comparing an ant with the bacteria clinging to the dung it feasted on. He was beginning to understand now what the skeleton had meant. Death. Oh, death, in this way, wasn't a death at all, but a transition, a becoming. For in the arms of the worm, ensconced within the cool, damp caverns underneath Snake Hill, he would achieve something, attain something, and in doing so, pass beyond what fools called existence and clung to so dearly, as if a single breath of waking life were worth the strain it put on the soul. Shub, Niggurath, on the Conqueror Worm. He closed his eyes, spreading out his arms to accept his fate. I'm home. Two tendrils lashed out of the thing, accompanied by a burst of gas from one of the jiggling mouths. They touched his arms,
suction feelers sinking into his skin, and he hissed as pain coursed through his arteries. The creature tasted his insides, and the tendrils retreated, leaving the ragged ends of arteries to spurt blood. Whether the creature liked it, he couldn't say. But when Elmer Rougerie felt the ends of the tendrils pressing against his closed eyelids, he understood. His eyeballs popped like ripe cherries, and the scream he let out could have woken the dead. Upstairs in the saloon, there was a rattle of bones, but that stopped along with the scream as the creature's slimy appendages dug into the old man's brain, and, finding nothing of any particular interest, withdrew its tentacles. The old man's body collapsed, limp and lifeless, and the creature returned from whence it came. A few hours later, a coyote, flea-bitten and half-starved, came upon the corpse. But the meat was far from fresh, and the smell clinging to it stung the canine's nostrils. He took a cursory sniff and turned away in search of something more palatable.